okay. Well, good Saturday morning. It's a little windy out there. Been noticing, maybe it's a figment of my imagination, but I think the levels of wind are higher than I remember them typically. I guess there's more energy in the atmosphere and all that. Happy Earth Day week. EcoShock is on. I'm on all the way till 1 o'clock with the Radio Free Labor crew. I wonder if Bob Pelesny has sent me a text wishing me well. Nope. I wonder how he's doing down in the Delta. But I'm pretty assured that Gus and Stephanie will be in, and maybe I'll have some wits about me by then. It's been an okay morning. Hope yours is going all right. Mumia Abu-Jamal has a commentary, and I should run down. I only have two features other than, well, there's always the Mumia Abu-Jamal when he makes one commentary from Prison Radio. .org. Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier essay, weekly column, which still has low levels. Maybe that's for people to listen to on headphones on the web. I always have to amplify it. But anyway, talking about a political prisoner in Egypt. Well, let's hear from Mumi Abu-Jamal first. The last part of the show, and play it all tomorrow, maybe if I can, is an interview with Jeremy Scahill, or by Jeremy Scahill, with Noam Chomsky. Scahill hasn't been out and about much lately, as far as I can tell. Maybe he's writing another book, which is what I always say about Mumi Abu-Jamal, though he could be working on his court case as well. A lot of things floating around. The piece from Rising Up with Sonali, who I haven't visited in a while, is about Trump. Trump supposedly stormed off the stage or a soundstage with Piers Morgan. What a couple those guys are. As I suggested, those are the kinds of guys that would go to the testicular tanning booth together. But supposedly the promotional material is that he walked out. Trump's got an audio tape that supposedly conveys something completely different, and maybe he's got good audio engineers in a New York minute, though he's living in New York, in Florida now, right? Anyway, people say enough about him, but, well, no one's put the wooden stake or the silver bullet, whatever's appropriate. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others. Here's Mumia's commentary, and this is what brought him back to the commentary stage. It's okay, one more thing to do here before we hear from Mumia. Donate your car. It's supposedly car easy, or 500 ride, 855-500-RIDE. Get your ride down the road and out of your yard. I've been saying that for a while myself. Here's Mumia.
Another life, another loss. They came to America to escape from inter-ethnic wars in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, in Central Africa. Like many refugees of war, they thought that America was the land of peace. The Loyola family settled in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and began living their lives as refugees have done for generations. But something as small as a traffic incident revealed the limits of the land of peace. 26-year-old Patrick Loyola faced a car stop when he apparently felt unsafe after a cop stopped his vehicle. He bursts into a sprint with a cop in hot pursuit. When the cop pulls a taser, Loyola seems to cover it with his hands, thus blocking its effect. Someone points a phone cam at the altercation, which shows a cop, seemingly, on Laoya's back, pushing his head downward. A shot is heard. And Patrick, Laoya is gone. Dead from a bullet in the back of his head. Once again, driving while black is a capital offense. For love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Okay, right to another political prisoner. Amy Goodman's piece for today. Copaganda. I've never heard the expression before. I'm so surprised. Well, there was a demo at Parkland about former police chief Al Finney teaching community policing. The irony doesn't escape many people in the community. The outrage, I guess I should say, too. Here's the right button to push here.
Ala Abdel Fattah has not yet been defeated. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. 40-year-old Egyptian political prisoner Ala Abdel Fattah has embarked on a hunger strike to the death. A leader of the 2011 Arab Spring in Cairo's Tahrir Square that overthrew the longtime U.S.-backed dictator Hosni Mubarak, Ala has been repeatedly targeted for his activism by successive Egyptian governments. He spent 8 of the last 9 years in prison. The dubious crime of broadcasting false news earned him an additional 5-year sentence last December. He is in prison for his ideas and his words, write the editors of You Have Not Yet Been Defeated, the just-published collection of Ala's writings. The editors chose to remain anonymous to avoid the same persecution that Ala has suffered at the hands of the current president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Ala's youngest sister, 28-year-old Egyptian filmmaker and activist Sana Saif, who herself has spent more than 3 years in prison, is now in the United States on a national tour to promote Ala's book and to advocate for his freedom. The Egyptian government is doing all it can to silence Ala Abdel Fattah, so we rely here on interviews he gave during those fleeting moments over the last decade when he was free. Ala first appeared on the Democracy Now! NewsHour in February of 2011 as the Arab Spring was sweeping across Egypt. Tell us, Ala, it's great to have you with us, a prominent Egyptian blogger, democracy activist. What is happening in front of the presidential palace, one of a number of new places that are being occupied by protesters, like Egyptian state TV as well, and the parliament?
In front of the TV building, it's a big crowd. We can't shut down the TV building because of its shape, and it's heavily barricaded by the army. But what we're trying to do is put pressure on the employees working inside to join us, to revolt and refuse to spread state propaganda.
Ala's activism during the revolution landed him in jail, that time for 2 months. He spoke on Democracy Now! 2 days after his release.
I was in a complete darkness for 5 days. It was very filthy and very crowded. There was 9 of us in a 2x3 meters cell, having no access to water or toilet except 10 minutes per day. So basically they knew they couldn't torture me because of the solidarity and the media attention. So they just made sure to try and use every other measure to put me at discomfort. Or at a psychological pressure.
Journalist and Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdelkaddous is also on the book tour. Sharif works with Madamasser, one of the only independent media outlets in Egypt. Speaking on Democracy Now!, he described the al-Sisi regime's increasing reliance on incarceration.
There's this kind of ballooning of the prison population because the government, the regime, doesn't really deal with any of the social, deep social, economic, and political problems that are in the country except through incarceration or other forms of oppression.
K. Case in point is Egyptian TikTok influencer Hanin Hassam, jailed on alleged human trafficking charges. She was instructing women how to earn money by sharing videos on a platform called Likee. She was first sentenced to 10 years, reduced this week to 3 years, with a fine of over $10,000, about three times Egypt's average annual salary. Ala comes from an activist family, from his late father, Ahmed Saif el-Islam, a human rights lawyer, to his mother, the mathematician and professor Leila Swaif. After she and her daughters protested in front of the prison where Ala was being held, her youngest, Sana, was beaten and arrested. She was imprisoned for a year and a half. Sana said on Democracy Now!,
"What moves me, what keeps us going, is that we as a family want to survive and want to unite in peace. So I don't think they are giving us any choice but to resist them."
Ala told Sharifa Bokadous in a recorded interview in 2014.
"When we talk about the revolution while living it, we're talking about a dream, you know, a wish, something that we're trying to fulfill, something that we're trying to create. But you can only talk about it as being over or not, and so on, in the distance, you know, while you're looking back. And so when I say defeat, I mean, you know, in the sense of in a battle. But we'll continue to exist, and since we'll continue to exist, there continue to be other struggles and so on. It's not like you have a choice. I mean, an individual might have a choice if they have a way out, but most people don't have a choice. You know, we cannot all immigrate. And it's not like the migrant labor gets a good deal anywhere in the world. So I mean, if what you're trying to do is to achieve a life of dignity and safety and prosperity for yourself and for your loved ones, then you have no choice."
Sana Saif and Sharifa Bokadous are touring the United States to raise awareness of Ala Abdel Fattah's dire plight, now in his fourth week on hunger strike. Meanwhile, Ala's family managed to obtain UK citizenship for him, as his mother, though Egyptian, was born in London. An immediate intervention by both the Biden administration and the British government would provide the best hope to save this courageous political prisoner. Ala Abdel Fattah, you have not yet been defeated. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay. I was going to play the Chomsky in its entirety, but I guess I'll try and do that tomorrow. Some of the international aspects are in the last part, China, India. But I'm going to go ahead and play this interview Sonali Kalantgar did with a guy at Eastern Michigan. I can't remember where that's located. I should know, I suppose. He's a white-collar criminologist, which we probably need a lot more of. Deference to the wealthy is just ludicrous in this country, it seems to me. I think that's why Trump got away with it all the many years. That's why Felix Sater, who went state's evidence and was FBI protected, even though he didn't, they apparently didn't ask him about Trump, though. They asked him about the usual targets. Even then, it was the Russian oligarchs. Not to say that they oughtn't to be targeted, they should, but how about some of these American oligarchs? I use that advisedly. I always try to say United States or the states. Speaking of economic journalist, guy I go to pretty frequently, kind of helped inspire my article in the Public Eye about vaccine apartheid, if you will, with a massive quote of his. He's giving away his book, Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. It's from a few years ago, but he's now giving it away. You can go to his Beat the Press blog at the Center for Economic and Policy Research and find your way to an article that will get you to a link to the piece. And yeah, already 15 minutes in. That's can't do the calculations real quick. I'm here all through the Radio Free Labor because Bob's not here to run the board. Maybe I'll do more than run the board. We'll see. Gus promised that there would be some hijinks, but I don't know. I can't talk about horror films or WWF or anything like that. But ask me about the Bundesliga, if you would. Okay, here's Sonali with, what's the guy's name again? Greg Barak, Criminology on Trump, is a book coming out in the middle of the next month. Crimes of the Powerful, so the broader context. It's always important. He's just an outlier in a few ways.
Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Each time it appears as though a criminal charge may be brought against Donald Trump, the effort fizzles out and Trump remains free from accountability. The former president is under investigation from many sides, chief among them the House January 6th Committee, which is investigating wrongdoing in the insurrection on Capitol Hill and attempts to overturn the November 2020 election. But the Department of Justice has also been investigating Trump and so far brought no charges. Most recently, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, which has been looking into financial wrongdoing by Trump's New York-based businesses, has also dropped the ball. We turn now to Greg Barak, Emeritus Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Eastern Michigan University, award-winning author and editor of numerous books on crime, justice, media, violence, criminal law, homelessness, and human rights. He's the co-founder and North American editor of the Journal of White Collar and Corporate Crime. He joins me to discuss his new book called Criminology on Trump. Welcome to the program, Greg.
Thank you for having me today, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about the issues around the January 6th insurrection. It should have been fairly obvious that Trump egged on his supporters to attack the Capitol Hill building and, you know, endanger the lives of lawmakers and others. We've had, as I mentioned, the Justice Department and the House Committee investigating this. Why has nothing really happened? There's been just so much investigation. Here we are in April 2022, and yet there have been no charges brought specifically against Trump.
Well, we can zero in on the three different cases. The one in New York involving his businesses, we would have thought by now a prosecution would have occurred. An indictment of Trump and other members of his family, like his CEO and a couple and his comptroller. It looks doubtful, but that case is still strong. It doesn't seem like Alvin Bragg is interested, although there's pressure and he seems to be saying that they haven't closed the case out. That remains to be seen. In terms of the Department of Justice and the insurrection, I believe that they are investigating and they're doing their own independent investigation. And I think that continues to take time. I have not ruled that out. And it could come as late as before the 24 election, but hopefully it would come before that. But that remains to be seen. The most interesting one, I think, is in Georgia and Fulton County. I just read earlier today that Fannie Willis, the district attorney there, has interviewed some 50 people voluntarily, and that there are 30 people who refuse to respond, and that she is seeking subpoenas for those individuals. So, you know, the wheels of justice move slowly. In Trump's case, they don't seem to ever quite get there, at least historically, with respect to his criminal behavior. He has been the Houdini of white-collar crime, as I like to refer to him as.
So there's political crimes, then there's white-collar crimes. These are somewhat separate, although, you know, Trump being who he is, blurred so many lines all the time. Even while in office, he violated numerous ethical boundaries and just, you know, violated policies. And rules about things that he could and couldn't do. At the White House, he mixed up politicking with running the country, you know, campaigning with running the country over and over again. And he just simply never has been held accountable. So why is this the case? I mean, you mentioned Alvin Bragg. Let's just look at the Manhattan District Attorney's office. Alvin Bragg is a progressive district attorney. He's so progressive that Zephyr Teachout wrote an article in The Nation just about a year ago saying that this is the man to take on powerful elites. And Alvin Bragg has mysteriously held back. One of the attorneys on the case resigned in protest. And he's a, you know, Alvin Bragg is a progressive. Why would there be such reluctance on the part of these folks to go after Trump?
Backlash.
Backlash from whom, though?
Just backlash from Trumpist supporters. Backlash from politics. Even though, you know, it's a Democratic stronghold in terms of New York politics. Prosecutors don't want to lose. They don't want to not have a slam dunk case. The excuse that they're giving at the moment in this case is that the comptroller Connolly is taking the heat, as he did in a previous case involving fraud, where he alleged that he did not know what he was doing was not proper, and supposedly that they're hanging this case on him as well with respect to the financial statements. I personally think that's a bogus explanation. As the attorney, you know, Pomerantz, that you referred to, who resigned, he said that there was plenty of evidence. And what we're really talking about when we talk about Trump is what he excels at. I mean, he is engaged in all types of crime, state crime, white collar crime, corporate crime, organized crime. You know, there's no area of criminality that he hasn't participated in, but where he specializes or where he is excels over the years has been at falsifying business records and annual financial statements. There's no one better at that than him. And so the pattern is there for 30, 40 years. It's not new. It's hard to see why Alvin Bragg would not have gone forward with this case. I don't think that will be the case with Merrick Garland, even though there's a lot of heat and pressure in that direction. The notion that we don't want to politicize these cases, they're always political. There's no way that you can get out from under that.
Especially when we're talking about a former president. I mean,
right,
by virtue
right,
of
right,
that.
It, right. And, you know, this is new grounds. Former presidents have never been, you know, prosecuted for a crime. And certainly those that have been impeached once have not. And those who have been impeached twice don't look like they are at this point in time. But I don't think the clock has run out yet. And with respect to New York, there's this esoteric law that says if Donald Trump and family have moved from New York, that the statutes of limitations pick up another 5 years. So as people thought they were running out, they may not be. So this may be another stimulant for Trump to run in 24. Hmm. So he can push that out to 29.
Right. So let's talk about your book, Criminology on Trump. You paint a sort of, the book isn't just about his crimes. One of the things that jumped out at me was that it's a sort of holistic, even psychological portrait of who Trump is to help us understand how he keeps, seemingly committing alleged crimes and getting away with them. So take us through that. There have been so many books written on Trump over the last 5-6 years. Perhaps chief among them is the book by his own relative, Mary Trump, who has a background in psychology. But why do you paint, what is the psychological portrait that you think we should know about Trump when we think about him as a criminal?
I make the case that he's, you know, he's sick and he's disturbed. He has, you know, multiple conditions, but I don't think that he's mentally ill in the sense that he doesn't know the difference between right and wrong. He's a rational player. He is not self-deceived. He fully understands what he's saying. He doesn't believe his lies for a moment. He is a rational player. He is a performer. He is a con artist. He's a gaslighter. I mean, all of these things contribute to his continuation to elude a law. He also knows the law better than most people. I mean, he has a, you know, he's been involved in some 4,000 lawsuits. Wow. He knows where he can go, where he can't go. He's very slick at what he does. He's nevertheless not a very contented person. He's an angry person. He's all the labels that people talk about: narcissistic, egocentric, without any empathy. But even those things are don't tell the whole picture. He's a complicated person.
So there's this sense, if you study Trump as a crime, you know, as a criminal, as somebody who's engaged in all of these nefarious dealings, that if you dig your heels in, the lesson that he sort of offers to fellow criminals is that if you dig your heels in, if you lie, if you deny, if you, you know, respond aggressively, you can win. You can get away.
Well, you may get away in sort of the popular narrative, and you may be able to convince people of the lie. Obviously, many people share that lie even with him. I don't think that he wins because he repeats his stories. You know, he wins most of his cases. He loses about a third of them, but the vast majority are tossed out, are thrown away. So he escapes for reasons that he mixes legal and illegal activities. And let me give a great example. Part of Trump's power lies in the fact that he is part of a global and American system of kleptocracy. And what I mean by that is he's working with banks, only one bank. All the other banks have stopped playing ball with him. He's working with Deutsche Bank, historically the most criminal bank out there, paid, you know, $600 million to the United States and the UK in 2017 for alleged $2 billion worth of laundering. When it comes to worldwide transactions, suspicious transactions, more than half of those are Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank plays in illegitimate money, laundered money, dirty money. Donald can't get financed since the early 90s by other banks. The only bank that's played ball with him, besides organized crime that's supported his monies and other laundered money through the world, has worked with Deutsche Bank. But at the same time, while that's not legal, there are many ways in which you can launder money that is totally legal through shell companies, offshore companies, both in the United States and outside the United States. Many of Donald's properties have been bought in Trump Tower through shell companies. We don't know who the owners are. These have been cash deals. So there's an enormous way in which dirty money finds its way into the United States legally. And that's part of the problem. Part of the problem is Donald, when he says he's not alone in doing these things, is correct.
Right.
He's not alone. And when he says, why are you picking on me? He has a point. Other entities like himself are doing similar things.
I remember during the debate that he had with Hillary Clinton before the 2016 election, the issue about his taxes came up. And when she basically accused him rightly of you know, not paying enough taxes or it being clear that he avoids taxes, he basically says, it makes me smart to avoid taxes. It doesn't make me a tax avoider.
Well, it makes him smart if he's, you know, doing things within the law. And a lot of the law allows him to do such things as conduct business and sell his properties to money that has come from not legitimate sources. And we don't know who those people are, because we allow them to set up shell companies, because attorneys and accountants, when they do this, they get paid for doing this service. It's a very, you know, it's $500 to $1,000, $2,000 an hour for these kinds of services. So my point is, there are legal venues for him to do that, but that's not his sole way in which he obtains cash. He also obtains cash directly with loans from a bank that has collected billions of dollars in laundered money themselves. And they've passed that to Donald. I mean, the interesting question is, Donald sued Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank sued him. They've countersued each other, but they continue to do business all the way up until the insurrection.
So, as a criminologist, what do you think needs to happen to ensure accountability? I mean, it just, given that he is this symbol of impunity in this country, it just seems like a big slap in the American people's face if he just walks away scot-free.
It's absolutely true. It would be, but not just from the business end of it. I mean, that's one contention, and all of the corruption, you know, that's been involved in his administration, the little corruption, the big corruption, all of that has been, you know, a slap in the face of all of our laws, not just economic, constitutional, and otherwise. And this case cannot be separated from what's happening in Russia and in Ukraine today, can't be separated from the autocratic versus democratic struggles that we see globally. It's all part of it. The United States can't make a case for democracy if it lets Donald Trump go free. If it doesn't prosecute Donald Trump for these crimes that everybody saw in plain sight, it makes a mockery of our system. So to me, that's the pressure that is starting to play out behind the scenes in this case. So there are multiple faces to be slapped if Donald, you know, eludes justice one more time, and he's been doing it now for 50 years.
So finally, Greg, what do you say to those people who, after Trump left the White House, just didn't want to hear his name? I mean, as a journalist, I've encountered this. If I bring it up, I've even had editors, you know, say, well, let's not mention him by name. You know, we can't keep focusing on Trump. He just sucks up too much oxygen. We're done. You know, he thrives on attention. And so I imagine that that's a little tough for you to encounter, as you've written a book about criminology on Trump.
But no, what do you mean? You know, I'm schizophrenic like everybody else. I got sucked into this. I didn't start out to be a Trumpologist. I ended up being that. Most of the people who write about Trump wouldn't identify themselves as Trumpologists because they've taken snapshots of him, and they've looked at him at different places. There are more than a few, such as Mary Trump and others who have gone through his history and you know his entire life. Zero me back to your question again,
Sarah. Which was, you know, what do you say to those people who feel that giving Trump attention is helping him?
Oh, yeah, no publicity is good. You know, any publicity is good publicity.
But then, of course, not paying attention to him ensures that he gets away with it.
Well, you can't not pay attention to him. I mean, you don't have to focus on him daily in the news, but he's still in the news daily, even if you don't focus on it. But you have to look at the consequences and the things that the Republican Party is doing, you know, statewide. You know, that's the way in which, you know, you can focus in on the effects of Trumpism and how he has stolen that party and how that party has become nothing other than a shadow of Trump and a means of the empowerment. So you do it, you know, you can't escape it, at least not until the 22 elections. If he fizzles there with his backed candidates, he may become yesterday's news. I suspect he won't fizzle with a sizable number of his candidates because, well, I don't know what you say to people, but you can't leave them alone. I mean, you just have to deal with the consequences of what we're experiencing day to day, from the State House to the White House, and you know, every place in between. He's left a mark. There's a plan. There's something going on, and people are accommodating his desires.
Well, Greg, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck to you with your new book.
Thank you very much, Sonali.
My guest has been Greg Barak, Emeritus Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Eastern Michigan University. We've been discussing his new book, Criminology on Trump. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com. By becoming a subscriber, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Okay, that's books out of the middle of next month, Criminology on Trump. I like the subtitle better, Crimes of the Powerful. Well, he has this exceptional view. What are U.S. ideals? I thought U.S. ideals were greed is good and that he's just implementing it. That's maybe what he thinks of, too. Noam Chomsky has a long time been disabusing people of that notion. For a long time, the last major publishing house to publish him, and there were consequences. The book was called Deterring Democracy. After that, he went to other imprints, though I think he's had some major publishing houses subsequently. I've been playing a little bit from his understudy at Arizona, which is David Gibbs, professor, who's also written a major book on the Balkans. That's out now. But without further ado, Jeremy Scahill, just 22 minutes. This is an hour-long segment, so I'm editing it on the fly. I'll be here for Radio Free Labor, and try to play the entirety of this tomorrow at 5 to 6 on the other show I host called Window on the World. So my name is Paul Muth, and this is the News from Neptune Radio Edit. And, let's get to this now as much as we can in the next 20 minutes.
Thank you very much for joining us here at The Intercept for this discussion with Professor Noam Chomsky. We're going to be discussing today the Russian government's invasion of Ukraine, the horrors that we've seen coming out of Ukraine, the bloodshed, the massacres, the killings. But also we are witnessing a major assertion of power by the United States in Europe. Calls for expanding U.S. militarism in Europe, European governments pledging to spend more money on weapons systems and to increase their activities as arms brokers. The United States at present is the largest weapons dealer in the world. At the same time, our guest Noam Chomsky says that this was an act of aggression, a state-sponsored act of aggression that belongs in the history books alongside the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, as well as the 1939 invasion of Poland by both the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. I want to welcome Professor Noam Chomsky to this forum here on The Intercept. Noam, thank you very much for being with us.
Pleased to be with you.
I want to start because there's been a lot of discussion on the left in the United States among anti-war activists on how to make sense of what a just response would look like to Vladimir Putin's decision to invade Ukraine and the mass killing that we are seeing. We can take time to talk about the broader historical context, and you've been discussing this a lot in other interviews. But I want to just start by asking you, is there any aspect of the U.S., NATO, and European Union response to this invasion that you believe is just? The weapons transfers to Ukraine, the sweeping economic sanctions and attempts to entirely isolate not only Russia and Putin, but ordinary Russians. Is there any aspect of the government response to this by the U.S., NATO, or the European Union that you agree with?
I think that support for Ukraine's effort to defend itself is legitimate. If it is, of course, it has to be carefully scaled so that it actually improves their situation and doesn't escalate the conflict to lead to destruction of Ukraine and possibly beyond. Sanctions against the aggressor are appropriate, just as sanctions against Washington would have been appropriate when it invaded Iraq or Afghanistan or many other cases. Of course, that's unthinkable given U.S. power. And in fact, the few times it has been done, the one time it has been done, the U.S. simply shrugged its shoulders and escalated the conflict. That was Nicaragua, when the U.S. was brought to the world court, condemned for unlawful use of force, ordered to pay reparations, responded by escalating the conflict. But so it's unthinkable in the case of the U.S., but it would be appropriate. However, I still think it's not quite the right question. The right question is, what is the best thing to do to save Ukraine from a grim fate, from further destruction? And that's to move towards a negotiated settlement. There are some simple facts that aren't really controversial. There are two ways for a war to end. One way is for one side or the other to be basically destroyed. And the Russians are not going to be destroyed. So that means one way is for Ukraine to be destroyed. The other way is some negotiated settlement. If there's a third way, no one's ever figured it out. So what we should be doing is devoting all the things you mentioned, if properly shaped, but primarily moving towards a possible negotiated settlement that will save Ukrainians from further disaster. That should be the prime focus. That requires, we can't look into the minds of Vladimir Putin and the small clique around him. We can speculate, but can't do much about it. We can, however, look at the United States, and we can see that our explicit policy, is rejection of any form of negotiations. The explicit policy was, goes way back, but it was given a definitive form in September 2021 in the September 1st joint policy statement that was then reiterated and expanded in the November 10th charter of agreement. And if you look at what it says, basically says no negotiations. What it says is it calls for Ukraine to move towards what they called an enhanced program for entering NATO, which kills negotiations, increased sending of, this is before the invasion, notice, an increase in the dispatch of advanced weapons to Ukraine, more military training, joint military exercises, weapons placed on the border. We can't be sure, but it's possible that these strong statements may have been a factor in leading Putin and his circle to move from warning to direct invasion. We don't know. But as long as that policy is guiding the United States, it's basically saying, quote Ambassador Chaz Freeman, it's saying, let's fight to the last Ukrainian, basically what it amounts to. So the questions you raised are important, interesting, just what is the appropriate kind of military aid to give Ukrainians defending themselves, enough to defend themselves, but not to lead to an escalation that will just simply lead to massive destruction, and what kind of sanctions or other actions could be effective in deterring the aggressors. Those are all important, but they pale into insignificance in comparison with the primary need to move towards a negotiated settlement, which is the only alternative to destruction of Ukraine, which of course Russia is capable of carrying out.
You know, it's interesting because Volodymyr Zelensky has been really lionized, particularly in the US and Western European media, and it's almost a sort of he's become a kind of caricature with these grand sweeping historical comparisons, and often the quotes from him are intended to give the appearance of this defiant leader who is going to fight to the end. But when you read between the lines and you read what Ukrainian negotiators are saying, when you read what Zelensky says when pressed on conditions for peace, he seems to be extremely aware of the factors that you're citing, that this has to end in a negotiation. And I want to ask you about the role of the US and European media in sort of perpetuating this mythology around Zelensky and the way in which it seems to kind of undermine the seriousness of the negotiators of Ukraine or of Zelensky when he is talking in a nuanced manner. It seems that there's this intent to kind of create a caricature rather than actually listening to the conditions that Ukraine is stating it can live with.
Yes, you're absolutely right. If you look at the media coverage, Zelensky's very clear, explicit, serious statements about what could be a political settlement, crucially neutralization of Ukraine, those have been literally suppressed for a long period, then sidelined in favor of heroic Winston Churchill impersonations by congressmen, others, and casting Zelensky in that mold. So yes, of course, he's made it pretty clear that he cares about whether Ukraine survives, whether Ukrainians survive, and has therefore put forth a series of reasonable proposals that could well be a basis for negotiation. We should bear in mind that the nature of a political settlement, the general nature of it, has been pretty clear on all sides for quite some time. In fact, if the US had been willing to consider them, there might not have been an invasion at all. Before the invasion, the US basically had two choices. One was to pursue its official stance, which I just reviewed, which makes negotiations impossible and may have led to war. The other possibility was to pursue the options that were available. To an extent, they're still somewhat available, attenuated by the war. But the basic terms are pretty clear. Sergei Lavrov, Russian foreign minister, announced at the beginning of the invasion that Russia had two main goals. two main goals: neutralization of Ukraine and demilitarization. Demilitarization doesn't mean getting rid of all your arms. It means getting rid of heavy weapons connected to the interaction with NATO aimed at Russia. What his terms meant basically were turn Ukraine into something like Mexico. So Mexico is a sovereign state, can choose its own way in the world, no limitations, but it can't join a Chinese-run military alliance emplacing advanced weapons, Chinese weapons, on the US border, carrying out joint military operations with the People's Liberation Army, getting training and advanced weapons from Chinese instructors and so on. In fact, that's so inconceivable that nobody even dares to talk about it. I mean, if any hint of anything like that happened, we know what the next step would be. No need to talk about it. So it's just inconceivable. And basically, Lavrov's proposals were saying, they could plausibly be interpreted as saying, let's turn Ukraine into Mexico. Well, that was an option that could have been pursued. Instead, the US preferred it to do what I just described as inconceivable for Mexico. Now, that's not the whole story. There are other issues. One issue is Crimea. Fact of the matter is Crimea is off the table. We may not like it. Crimeans apparently do like it, but the US says we're never going to concede it. Well, that's a basis for permanent conflict. Zelensky has sensibly said, let's put that off for further discussion. That makes sense. Another issue is the Donbas region. Now, that's been a region of extreme violence for 8 years, both sides. Ukrainian shelling, Russian shelling, landmines all over the place. Lots of violence. There are OSCE observers, European observers on the ground who give regular reports. You can read them, they're public. They don't try to assess the source of the violence. That's not their mission, but they talk about its radical increase. According to them, I think if my memory is correct, about 15,000 people or something in that neighborhood may have been killed in the conflict over the last 8 years since the Maidan uprising. Well, something has to be done about Donbas. The proper reaction, which maybe the Russians would accept, would be a referendum, an internationally supervised referendum to see what the people of the region want. One possibility, which was available before the invasion, was implementation of the Minsk II agreements, which provided for some form of autonomy from in the region within a broader Ukrainian federation, something like maybe Switzerland or Belgium or other places where there are federal structures, conflict, but confined within federal structures. That would have been a possibility. Whether it could have worked, there's only one way to find out, to try. US refused to try, instead insisted on a super militant position, official position, which, as far as I know, the press has yet to report. You can tell me if I'm wrong, but I have never seen one reference anywhere in the mainstream press, so occasionally way at the margins, any reference to the official US position of September 1st, 2021, the reiteration and expansion of it in November in the charter. Actually, I saw one reference to it in the American Conservative Journal, which did refer to it. But, and of course, on the left, people have talked about it. But the US insisted on that position, which the alternative would have been to pursue the option of saying, okay, your main goals are neutralization and demilitarization, meaning Mexico-style arrangement. Let's pursue that. With regard to Crimea, let's accept Zelensky's sensible position that let's delay it. We can't deal with it now. With regard to the Donbas region, work towards some kind of framework with autonomy based on the opinions of the people who live there, which can be determined by an internationally supervised referendum. Would the Russians agree? We don't know. Would the United States agree? We don't know. All we know is they're rejecting it officially. Could they be pressed to accept it? Don't know. We can try. That's the one thing we can hope to do. There is a sort of a guiding principle that we should be keeping in mind. No matter what the issue, the most important question is, what can we do about it? Not what can somebody else do about it. That's worth talking about. But from the most elementary point of view, the major question is, what can we do about it? And we can, in principle at least, do a lot about US policy, less about other things. So I think that's where the focus of our attention and energy should be.
I want to ask you about some of the statements that Biden administration officials have made in recent days. On the Sunday talk shows this past weekend, you had the National Security Advisor and the Secretary of State both laying out what was almost a sort of overt war plan for seeking to fundamentally weaken the Russian state, and talking about the war in Ukraine as helping to achieve a goal of a severely weakened Russia.
What we want to see is a free and independent Ukraine, a weakened and isolated Russia, and a stronger, more unified, more determined West.
To what extent are U.S. actions that we're witnessing now in Ukraine ultimately aimed at bringing down the government in Moscow of Vladimir Putin? Yes, there was the kerfuffle over Biden talking about this guy's got to go.
For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power.
But the actions are playing out in full public view. And I think a lot of people put too much weight on a particular quip of Joe Biden, though he may have intentionally said it that way. It's hard to tell right now with him whether he means to say something or not. But setting that aside, it does seem that a major aspect of the U.S. position right now is that this is a grand opportunity to they smell the blood of Putin in the water, I guess is what I'm saying, though.
Yes, I think the actions indicate that. But remember, there's something along with action, namely inaction. What is the United States not doing? Well, what it's not doing is rescinding the policies that I described. Maybe the American press doesn't let Americans know about them, but you can be sure that Russian intelligence reads what's on the official White House website, obviously. So maybe Americans can be kept in the dark, but the Russians read it and know about it. And they know that one form of inaction is not to change that. The other form of inaction is not to move to participate in negotiations. Now, there are two countries that could, because of their power, facilitate a diplomatic settlement. I don't say bring about, but facilitate, make it more likely. One of them is China, the other is the United States. China is being rightly criticized for a refusal to take this step. A criticism of the United States is not allowed. So the United States is not being criticized for its failure to take this step, and furthermore, its actions, which make this step more remote. Like the statements you quote on the Sunday talk shows, just imagine how they reach Putin and his circle. What they're saying, what they interpret it as meaning is, nothing you can do. Go ahead and destroy Ukraine as much as you like. There's nothing you can do because you're going to be out. we're going to ensure that you have no future. So therefore, you might as well go for broke. That's what the heroic pronouncements on the Sunday talk show mean. It may feel like, you know, again, Winston Churchill impersonations, very exciting, but what they translate into is destroy you.